I'm Scott Kahn, and this is the Orthodox Conundrum Podcast. Last Wednesday, I had the honor of recording a podcast episode with Rabbi Dr. Raphael Zarim, who is the Dean of the London School of Jewish Studies and holds the Rabbi Sacks Chair of Modern Jewish Thought there. He is also the author of a new book entitled Questioning Belief, Torah and Tradition in an Age of Doubt, which is published by Koren and came in second in this year's Rabbi Sacks Book Prize. The topic of our conversation was questions about the historicity of the Exodus from Egypt, as well as other questions that touch on foundational Jewish beliefs and fundamentals of faith. It was a wonderful conversation, and I intended to release it this past Monday. Unfortunately, my father, Robert Kahn, passed away later that night, and instead of editing a podcast, I flew to Boston for the funeral and most of the Shiva. I returned to Israel yesterday and concluded sitting Shiva this morning. I'm sure that in the coming weeks I'll have more to say about my dad, but now that I'm no longer sitting Shiva, I wanted to make sure that I release this episode in advance of Pesach, as I think that Rabbi Zarim's insights can greatly enhance our experience of the Seder. Please forgive the fact that this episode will be more lightly edited than most others. My father always enjoyed Pesach and ran our family Seder for many years, so I hope that this conversation can serve as an appropriate memorial to Yisrael ben Nachum Zeva Kohen, Zichrono Livracha. I'd also appreciate it if you read the words that I said at the funeral, which I have released in my Substack, Orthodox Conundrum Commentary, and which is linked in the show notes. With that, here's my conversation with Rabbi Dr. Raphael Zarim. Rabbi Dr. Raphael Zarim, thank you very much for joining me today on the Orthodox Conundrum Podcast.
Wonderful to be here, Scott.
You recently released a book entitled Questioning Belief, Torah and Tradition in an Age of Doubt, which discusses 12 fundamental questions in areas of the literal truth of the Torah, issues regarding ethics in Jewish law, such as whether slavery is moral, and collective punishment, other issues such as that, and about belief in God in general. As a way to start our conversation, I'd like to ask you, why did you write this book? What problem do you see that you are trying to solve?
So, Scott, I'll tell you, many people in the mainstream traditional Jewish world who practice mitzvot and live Jewish lives, but they have some sneaking suspicions or questions about fundamental issues of Torah, of, you know, did the flood actually happen? A guy leaned over in shul to me and said, do you think this stuff really happened? And it was a guy goes regularly to shul. And because we live in a modern world and we know what's going on because of the internet and vast closeness to knowledge that we have, we can find these answers so easily. And so it makes even the most religious Jew think, well, is this literally true? Or how do I look at that? I also believe it's a separate issue. We've been very influenced by other ways of looking at things. So our view of God, for instance, I think is very influenced by general society. And I think we need new ways of looking at these things because of the great knowledge that people have and the questions that they ask.
Then is there something that ties everything together in this book? Because you ask disparate questions about, for example, the historicity of the Exodus, which we are going to be speaking about primarily today. You talk about whether the flood actually happened. You also talk about belief in God. You talk about collective punishment. You talked about the idea of chosen people. Is that a racist concept? You have various answers, but is there a single thread that ties them all together, or do you take each one on its own merits? I guess what I'm asking, Rafi, is there a theme? Is there a general approach to Torah that you're trying to advocate throughout everything that you do, or do you look at each problem as an individual problem?
So, as always, yes and no, but I'll be clear. My father was a Yemenite Jew, and we take a lot of great stock in the literal words of the Torah, how it's expressed. And for me, each question or each issue that I'm asked, I always think, for me, what's an authentic Torah response? It's one that looks at the particular words and how they're expressed. So my first approach always is, when even asking about God, is to look at how does the Torah express those kind of things. And it's not always the most obvious places. So this, I look at the use of the word lidrosh over and over again in terms of belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and how it's used there. And so that's very much my approach. First of all, is to look at the way the words are used, and to question the assumptions of how we normally look at it. Is it to do with Western society while we look at a thing in a particular kind of way? And then I always look at the way Chazal analyzed this text and try and see different nuances of how they're expressing it. And so I try, as any academic would, you try and look at things with fresh eyes. That's the approach that I try and do. So what unifies me is, I suppose my method is, look at the key verses of the Torah, look at the way Chazal analyzed it, see contemporary resonances, and then go from there.
Okay, that's very interesting. Let me ask you specifically about God, because you mentioned that a couple times. God obviously is the big one above everything else, certainly. What mistakes in the normal way of looking at God do people often make such that you say we might need a different way of approaching God that is free from certain outside influences?
I think the two big ones are the idea that God is a separate being that exists like other things that exist. Maimonides, many general philosophers have rejected that. Maimonides clearly rejects that. The idea that God is a separate, identical being that we can think about is just, it's not true. So what, but well, most people go, well, then what is it? Because it either exists or it doesn't. But then you're stuck on words of existence. So the first thing is to let go of that. And I think the second mistake people make is, well, they say, I have emunah b'Hashem. But what does emunah mean? Does emunah mean I believe that I believe in a credo to make the statement that God exists, or I have a relationship to this thing? And the word emunah, and it's clear for anyone to see, if you look at the whole way through the Torah, the way the word emunah is used, it's much more akin to loyalty and to trust and faithfulness than it is a kind of statement of existence. So it's much more about being part of the Jewish people and emunah of the system. So in one line at the end of the chapter, I talk about it's much more about affiliation than affirmation.
You know, very much what you're saying now reminds me of things I've heard from Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamzatzal, as well as from Professor Menachem Kellner from the University of Haifa, who wrote a book, Must a Jew Believe Anything? And he makes a similar distinction between belief in versus belief that. And he suggests, perhaps controversially, that in belief in, absolutely, every Jew must believe in. But believing that something, there's nothing you technically must believe that is true.
Yes, so yes, I'm familiar with Menachem's book, and it's a fascinating one. I do another chapter called What Happens If You Still Have Difficulty With Belief? And instead of making the positive assertion that Menachem does is that it might not matter that much, I say, are you still accepted? Are you still inside if you're not sure? And I show, based on classical Chazal and modern response as well, that you're still inside, and therefore there's a value to your emunah, even if it's not based on some kind of real kind of deep-seated belief. So that's why I think I understand what Menachem is doing, but my approach is much more, you know, I don't want to make the statement for the sake of it. I want to explain to people, if you, because for me, God is part of the Lidrosh, is part of a search, a quest that you live your entire life. You deepen your relationship with God. It's not a yes or a no. For instance, in the Ten Commandments, if I say, you know, do you honor your parents? Yes or no? They go, well, it depends. No, yes or no. Well, last week I tried, next week I'll try. It's an ongoing relationship. Same with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Right, you teach each of those 10 statements as not an affirmation that you've now ticked a box, but the way that you live your life. Therefore, it's a quest your whole lifetime. And therefore, what I want to show people, as long as they're on some kind of quest, according to my reading of the sources, that you, even in the Rambam, that you're on the inside.
And by the inside, you mean inside the tent of valid Jewish belief, valid members of the community.
I'm Yisrael, that we need to care and love and support, that you're part of. And my ultimate proof is to show that King Achav, who literally publicly stated, I don't believe in God, and was a big sinner in many ways. But Chazal say he still won his wars, and many still think he made it to Olam Haba, even though another opinion says he doesn't, and that Achav is seen as included. And that was my example. But there's many. The Rambam makes a big deal of all these wayward people who are still part of the system, and Kal Vachomer for us today.
I realize this isn't our topic, but I'm fascinated by this, so I'm going to ask one more question about that. When you say that you're still inside the tent. And by the way, that's something which I certainly relate to. And when I mentioned Rabbi Lamb before, I was referring specifically to his famous essay, Faith and Doubt, mm-hmm. where he says there's a difference between denial and doubting and so on and so forth. That's not really our topic. But I'm curious if you think that what you're saying now is in line with the Rambam, because people like Professor Kellner would say they're not really working with the Rambam, that the Rambam did affirm a necessity of believing that something is true, the following proposition is true. I'm curious if you disagree with that reading of the Rambam, or you say that you're going in a different direction. And by the way, when I say going in a different direction, it might be the direction of the majority of Jewish philosophers, just the Rambam is such a large, important name, we often have him dominate our discussions in these matters.
I think the secret is to look, and I'm just looking at it now, to look at the end of where the Yud Gimel Ikarim comes in. Because the key issue is people think, oh, the Rambam said there's 13 principles of faith, you have to believe. He never wrote that as a booklet. It was never part of any prayer that he said, as you know. It's part of his introduction to a Perechelek. And just at the very end of there, he goes through the 13 principles and afterwards says, and if you're part of belief in these, then you're on the inside. But then I look very carefully about what he says, and you can still read in, according to the Rambam, that you can be included to an extent. I think the Rambam was talking about what I call Jewish citizenship. That's the way he's describing it. In other words, when you're a citizen of a country, You ascribe to certain principles, and that means you're part of the country. You have to go a very long way to not be a citizen anymore. And so I then talk about the end of the chapter. So I do think even with the Rambam, you can say that as long as you ascribe to the principle of these things, even if you have difficulty with them, it's only if you literally, Scott, stand up and reject them and publicly say, I definitely don't want to believe in this.
I've noticed that the Mishnah, which the Rambam is commenting on in Perek Chelek,
exactly,
is Ha'omer, somebody who says the following, and we could be medayik in that word. It's not somebody who thinks this, it's somebody who declares it. I also wonder at times, and this is not my own idea, but some of the ideas that the Rambam mentions in those 13 principles of faith, it seems he himself in other places didn't fully say them exactly in that way.
Exactly. So it's a question, what was Rambam saying when he said you have to believe? Right? Is he saying a matter, it's a physical fact that you know, or it's a these are legal statements, not historical or factual statements. And a legal statement is one you say, I subscribe to, I follow that. And even if there might be specifics that are slightly different, it's the same when the government, you know, told people to take vaccinations. Maybe it's dangerous for an American audience to say these things, but to take vaccinations and it will be healthy for you. In general, yes, of course, with so many people taking, there's going to be some people with side effects, but it was a legal principle in order for the majority to accept, which was the best way for society to survive. And in a similar way, the Rambam makes those statements. There's always exceptions. And by the way, in the Ma'ariv Nevuchim towards the end, he talks about exceptions to situations. So even, you know, you make a general statement. And by the way, if you want to be really accurate in the Rambam, if you read the Mishnah Torah, which I'm sure you have, every time he makes a statement and then he goes, Bamed Zavon Mamorim, what are we talking about? Which is always a limitation. So Maimonides' approach is to make a general statement and then to go to the specifics and say, yes, but, yes, but. So you have to read the Rambam as a whole. You know, people like to read the Rambam selectively. As you well know, either he was the Mishnah Torah man or he was the Ma'ariv Nevuchim. Until you see it's the same person, I don't think you've really understood the Rambam.
I think you're absolutely right about that. Far from me to say, but my great teacher, Professor Marvin Fox Zatzal, with whom I studied many years ago, that's certainly part of his understanding of the Rambam in his book, Interpreting Maimonides. Understanding the Rambam as a model for today requires understanding both the Rambam of the Mishnah Torah and the Maimonides of the Ma'ariv Nevuchim. In any case, Rafi, let's get back into our larger topic. Before we get to the Exodus from Egypt particularly, which obviously is relevant now, in particular coming up with Pesach, I want to ask you one more question on these topics about fundamentals of faith and questions of belief. How do you avoid falling into apologetics? Because some people will say that if you already want to believe, or you already do believe but you have questions, then you can find ways to, you use the metaphor of ticking off the boxes. Oh, I can answer this question like this, and I can answer this question like this, and I can answer this problem like this. But somebody who already does not believe this, somebody who already stands outside in his own mind or her own mind, someone who says, I don't accept these fundamentals, I don't believe in Torah, I don't believe in God, whichever of the principles or whichever the idea is someone doesn't believe, is it the same thing to bring them back in? Meaning, are the ways that you're trying to answer questions for people who want to believe, is this giving them permission to accept certain propositions? Or is it a way of convincing people who already do not believe and say, you know what, it's actually more logical to believe them?
It's a great question. And I thought a lot about this when I was writing the book. I mean, I talk in the introduction that I say that it is apologetics in the accurate sense of the term. Apologetics has gained a bad name, exactly the reason that you're saying that people kind of give spurious, quick answers to convince people of their argument. But classically in the Greeks, apologetics was a person who was passionate about a belief and wanted to give a reasonable, sensible defense of it. And I realized it's also therefore personal. It's their defense. So this is how I understand it. This is the approach that I've taken when I had these questions. I admit that I asked these questions myself. To try and avoid confirmation bias, I analyze the questions and go through the answers I don't quite like and try and negate what I'm arguing because I don't want to be kind of overconfident. Some people have a kind of a triumphalist approach to these things. Well, obviously God exists. Let me tell you the proofs. And now you will know and I know better than you. And I much more like to see myself as a kind of fellow traveler with our author and saying, here's what I've discovered. These arguments don't work for me. Well, I don't think the proofs, the classical proofs of God exist work. But then I make the point that the disproofs of God that the new atheists argue also don't work. So we have to do a different approach. But I'm trying to always be an honest writer on this. And I was interviewed at Jewish Book Week by a very interesting woman, Dr. Devorah Baum, who reads a lot of scripts and says she's very wary as a thoughtful Jew of people trying to convince her of things. And she feels that lots of books are written in what she calls bad faith. And she said, Rafi, when I read your book, I felt you were writing in good faith. You were honestly trying to express these issues and being aware of the limitations. And that was the approach that I took. And I write, actually, I don't think I'm going to convince you from 0 to 100 of something. I'm not trying to do that. I'm saying if you're intrigued by this issue, just intrigued even, or you want to believe it in some ways, here's a fellow traveler. Here's what I've discovered along the way. You might find these ideas helpful. They might be the one you might think you hadn't thought of at all, which is an interesting approach, another way of looking at Torah that changes you. Or it just might be interesting to know. And I got this, I'm sure you discovered as well, just by knowing people like by Dr. Norman Lamb and Nachum Rabinovitch and Soloveitchik. These are very smart people. These are very thoughtful people. And if they had thought about these issues and were still religious and it was okay to ask, then it's okay to be religious and it's okay to ask. The permission of just personality could sometimes be very powerful. So not that I'm on the level of those people, but the mainstream Orthodox rabbis are comfortable to discuss these issues in an honest way and try and find ways to faith opens and invites others to say, come on, let's go on the journey of faith.
That's beautiful. Thank you. And in that vein, what you write about Yetziat Mitzrayim, about the exodus from Egypt, is a great example of that idea that you are saying exactly what you really think. You're traveling along, admitting things that haven't made sense to you, as well as acknowledging that there are ways of understanding them. Here's how you summarize the dilemma regarding Yetziat Mitzrayim. I have been studying the Exodus for a long time. No matter how much I would like to, I know of no way to prove the veracity of the story as literally recounted in the Torah. An honest assessment of the information and facts precludes any scientific attempt to confirm its occurrence. Despite all this, the Exodus remains central to Jewish faith, of utmost importance to religious life, and essentially true, as will be explained. So, at the risk of giving people doubts that they may not have had before, let me ask you, Rafi, what are some of the reasons that people might indeed doubt the Torah's account as it's presented, alongside or perhaps apart from the general wariness of accepting miracle stories? In terms of the history that we know about it from Egyptology, from archaeology, and other fields, what are some of the big problems with talking about the historicity of the Exodus?
Well, there's a number, and I talk about them. It's very difficult to date it because the dating doesn't work. If you follow back from the way it describes that the Exodus happened a certain number of years, 480 or so years from the time of King Solomon, which the Tanakh talks about, then that puts you in a period where there are no Ramses pharaohs. The key issue, for instance, is that the earlier pharaohs had their main palaces in the south, not in the north. So by the time that we're there, they need to be in the north, and that doesn't work time. So even for
Well,
those
can I ask you, why do they
academic.
need to be in the north? What's the reason for that?
So the reason why, and this relates to the next issue, is because the pharaohs originally, the unification of Egypt was an important issue historically, and they much more kept themselves to themselves and then fought the Nubians in the south. They started engaging in the Middle East and in commerce and fighting only in the 18th and 19th dynasty when Seti Ramses and then Seti I go and invade and conquer Canaan. And so, as a result of that, because they're going to do much more in the north and there's trade routes and so on, they also have palaces in Karnak and so on, but they start building palaces, Pi Ramesseum and so on, in the Goshen, what's called the Delta region, right? Much, much nearer the coast. And that, historically, has to fit in as well. It doesn't quite work in that sense. Another thing is, if we say it's Ramses II or around that period, they conquered Canaan. Right. Now that helps explain why we didn't go Derech Eretz Pelishtim, because there were Egyptian outposts all the way along the coast. But it meant that 40 years later, when Moses then when Joshua invades the land of Israel, they wouldn't have just been facing 39 Canaanite kingdoms, they'd be facing the mighty power of Egypt again. So that makes it historically difficult as well. There's no mention of Moses in any of the stories. Now you might say, well, of course they're not going to mention that because he left. But Akhenaten, who was a king who they try and argue who's a monotheist, he wasn't really. He just kind of saw the sun as the pinnacle of the gods. But Akhenaten's temples were destroyed a lot. There was a big war against Akhenaten afterwards. But the archaeologists have found the fight between. So you might have expected that Moses, that you would see a person like that, or some kind of mention of Israel in any kind of way. Now, there's lots of answers to why we haven't found it, which I know as well. But that's a reasonable thing to maybe have thought. Also, the way the Torah tells it seems quite unrealistic. The numbers are just ridiculously large. And I've told you a little story since I'm doing this. It's about a rabbi who lost his faith. And how did he lose his faith? I won't say what denomination. It was Orthodox, but even with an Orthodoxy, it was a particular Hasidic sect. But why did he lose his faith? He did a master's in sanitation. There's lots of reasons why, Scott, right? And he learned about how sanitation
Isn't that how
works.
everyone loses their faith?
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can think of the line that I said, that we, what was it that did it for him? But when he realized, the sanitary needs of people, once you get more than a few thousand in one area, if you don't have good waste systems, everyone dies of disease. So the idea of these huge numbers, and we know from ancient Egypt, by the way, what the numbers of the whole country were. We have an idea of that. So the numbers are just, they don't quite work. And if you say that Chazal say that only a fifth went out, that makes it even more difficult. So in the beginning of my chapter on this, did the Exodus actually happen? I go through all these issues. And again, as a purely as an academic or modern person who wants to believe it's true, who's looking for sources, I just wanted to admit that, there's a huge mountain to climb.
Okay, before we get to some possible solutions to these problems, I'm going to ask a general question as well. Do you worry that by presenting the problems, you're going to create more of these rabbis who lose their faith, more people who say, I like the question better than the answer?
It's a great question. That's why I was so careful. And that sentence you read out, I wrote a number of times. I was so careful how I wrote it because I actually wrote, nevertheless, I believe that it's true. Even in that sentence, normally I wait to give the answer, but I put that. But the opening line, and I'll just read a couple of lines for it from the opening of the chapter, is the following. If the Exodus did not happen, then we really are in trouble. So much of Jewish tradition rides upon it. It's the foundation story of our faith. And so I begin in that way, and I show the author, the reader, my discomfort with even saying this. I put that line, even saying this makes me feel uncomfortable because I believe. So instead of being, you can't believe in it, and being forthright and trying to shock people, which I think, teachers do sometimes, I try and be honest and go, of course I want to believe this. Of course you want to. But when you read it, it's a bit more complicated. So, and then I just highlight those points because I then answer them, I feel that I haven't, caused a problem. But any educational process, Scott, always unpacks things people assumed already. It always challenges assumptions. But if you do it in a response, and I learned this very much from my teacher, Rabbi Sacks, always do it in a responsible way. If the controversial points that you make, never make that the center of your argument. It's childish. It's not just educationally wrong. It's childish. It's not the way to do things. The way to do it is along the way, you'll mention controversial things if needs to be. But you'll justify it and you'll always be trying to move to the end. And I said this in my introduction, by the way, when they asked Rav Henkin,
The elder of Henkin.
the older Henkin, the Posek, about are you allowed to give Chiddushim on the Torah, which are not according to Chazal, if it's on a non-halakhic issue. I mean, halakhic issue is a separate issue, I'm not enjoying that, but non-halakhic issues. And he said, yes, as long as they are to Mosif Yirat Shemayim, as long as they're to increase reverence for heaven. And that's what I'm trying to do in the book. So I really believe that that's the aim that I'm honestly trying to do. In that sense, it's pure apologetics. I'm upfront about it, but not in a kind of crass, arrogant way, in an honest, friendly way. That's how I'm trying to do it.
Well, also, if we assume that the reasons that, for example, you use the example of the numbers, if the reason that the numbers are given in an inaccurate way is in order to teach a different message, as opposed to simply it's wrong, then presumably, even after asking these questions, we've purified faith in some level. Because even though we may not have the emunah pshuta, the simple faith of saying, yes, it was 600,000 adult men, which means maybe 3 million people, but now we understand better why the Torah would use that number, because it's not there randomly, it's not a mistake, it's actually trying to teach a message. So in some way, it's not only that you're asking questions and then answering them, and people are a little bit worse off, hopefully they're better off, they have a deeper understanding of the text.
Well, again, and I write in the introduction that the process, I began as a defense of Judaism. But I began by rethinking it in a modern way. And the last chapter, because I've got to be honest, I want to mention this before the end, Scott, that I was very worried. It's very arrogant to come along and say, I'm a modern, intelligent person. I've got a PhD in physics. I look at the Torah and say, oh, it's not scientific enough for me. It's not moral enough for me, the modern Western person who knows it all. It's the height of arrogance. And I felt uncomfortable in a way. So I tried to write a different kind of way. And at the end, I pointed out that actually, even though I began by questioning belief and questioning the Torah, in the end, the Torah questions me because it challenges me. When I look at what the flood is really about, what the Exodus is really about, and as you say, reconsider it, reframe it, it then becomes a challenge to me to improve and to grow. And so I am helping people to have a real understanding, but a way that then challenges. And when I begin the essay in earnest on this one about the Exodus, I say, what is the purpose of telling the Exodus story in the Torah? It might seem an obvious question, the answer being, because that's what happens. But that's not convincing because it's not just what happened. It's so selective in what it mentions. It is so selective. It's so idiosyncratic in what it mentions, what it doesn't mention. So in the story of Purim, we know where the palace was, which rooms they were, all that kind of stuff with Ahasuerus and Haman and Esther Mordechai. In Egypt, we know nothing. Doesn't mention anything about the palace. Why not? Right? We know the names of loads of assistants in the poem story. There's no names of assistants in the Exodus. Why? Why is it Moshe versus Paro? The way the Torah, the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu chooses for this book to be written, it's selective, right? And I quote at the end from Rabbi Sacks about that. And I put it at the end of that chapter because I think it's a very challenging chapter. It was a very important point. And Rabbi Sacks wrote in a very important early book that people don't read called Christ and Covenant. He says, when the sages ask, why was this written in the Torah? Or why was this passage placed next to this? Their typical answer is not because that is how it happened, but to teach you that. That's the proper way of reading text. And I read this when I was, I read his books as they came out. So I've always had that way of looking at things. He made it very clear to me. And that, now, that's quite a radical statement to make if you see the implications of it. But on principle, it's obvious that Chazal are doing that, that the Torah is doing that. So the problem is we grew up with reading it as a history book. We just naturally did. And it wasn't, it was something else.
You know, what you're saying very much resonates. I've always said that about Midrashim, because about Midrashim, the question always is, did it happen? Or more specifically, people ask, is it true? And I say, of course it's true. Is it historically true? That's a different question. And on some level, I say, if it's historically true, and the only thing the Midrash is teaching us is that this is how it happened, well, that's where the story ends, and you're done, and you can go on to the next thing. If, on the other hand, that the Midrash is trying to teach you a lesson, that's when the work begins. So on some level, saying
exactly.
that it's true...
Yeah, we take it seriously, not literally.
Right. Now let's take the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim seriously, and I don't know, literally or not, I guess you'll tell us. Let's go through some of the ways that you answer or provide solutions or ways of dealing with these various problems that you mentioned.
I often use the word responses rather than answers, because I think responses are much more interactive and careful as opposed to this is the answer.
That makes sense. Okay. Then let me mention three types of responses that you mentioned in your book, three different ways, three tools in your toolbox that you've used. And I'd like to ask you to explain each one of them, and then we can use them for different issues that come up. The three tools you mentioned are educational imperative, literary form, and Egyptological resonance. These are three things that the Torah does, three ways the Torah speaks, I suppose, which can help us understand better what's going on. Can you explain each one of them first?
Yes. So the educational imperative is, it's like if you read, if you know, the Exodus will be made into a movie more than any other part of the Bible. Well, I'm not sure any other, but one of the main parts of the Bible. And so if you're a director reading the script, you're going to go, what the hell is going on? Because literally every couple of verses, there's interruption for halakha to be taught, or historical statement to be made. Like God says to Moses, tell the people, when they go to the land of Egypt, they're in Egypt. When you go to the land of Israel, go, but they're in Egypt now. He goes, when you're land of Israel and you've settled, and you have children. What do you mean when you have children? We're in Egypt now. And you will tell them this. It keeps jumping ahead to a nondescript future time with these progeny that haven't happened yet. And you'll tell them this. And the amount of educational verses is huge. And it keeps breaking up the text. No Hollywood director would make a movie in that way. And I try to flip it and say, actually, the main idea is an educational lesson and the historical story is used to explain it. I got this from the Haggadah. I first noticed this in the Haggadah. The central heart of the Haggadah is four, we all know, is four verses from Deuteronomy. When you bring your basket, and those four verses are then analyzed in the Haggadah, and they bring in verses to Exodus to explain them. Now, as an academic, that's crazy. Your primary text is your secondary text, right? The second time, and then you prove your secondary text. It's like going to a lecture about John F. Kennedy, and they show you as the main text the film by Oliver Stone called JFK. This is our main text. And to explain scenes in the film, they start bringing historical books to quote to explain a scene in the film. It's backward. You don't teach anything like that unless the most fundamental text is the movie or the retelling of the story. The whole point of Pesach is about retelling. Seder night, we never once in a systematic way tell the story of the Exodus from Shemot chapter 1 to 13. We keep telling stories of people telling the story of the going out of Egypt over and over again because it's about storytelling. And when I realized that, the Torah itself does that. And therefore, the educational imperative is the primary function of the story, not its historicity. That's the first one.
Before we move on to the next one, I'll just mention that I believe it's Rav Shagar who has said that the case of Yetziat Mitzrayim, the story is there for the sake of the story. In other words, the entire reason that we left is, so to speak, for the sake of being able to tell the story. It's very interesting.
There you go.
There we go. Same idea. Okay, now let's move on to that second idea, literary form. What do you mean by that?
So that is how the Torah writes its story. So I talk about, for instance, did Paro speak in Hebrew? Well, clearly not. So when power speaks, and as we're both big fans of Professor Joshua Berman, and he taught Nishmat for many years, and when he would teach about Pharaoh, "Nir Pim Atem, Nir Pim, lazy you guys, you are lazy." Do we know that Pharaoh really said that? Were we in the room to say that? Or it's being done as a style to show what kind of character that he is. So literary forms means that you immediately aren't asking the question, did it literally happen? And what's amazing is Chazal go crazy on this kind of stuff. The text clearly says the power in chapter one, at the end of chapter one, in chapter two, he dies, another one takes over. So that's why in the movie Prince of Egypt, Moshe grows up with Ramses too, because the one that kills the firstborn is not the same pharaoh as then says, won't let them go. That's what the Torah says. What does Rashi go? Well, he didn't actually die. He just got ill and they thought he was dead. So basic facts of the text, Chazal go, no. I'll give you another example. It says Pitom and Ramses. Okay, we built two store cities, which is wonderfully good. It doesn't say pyramids, which would have been wrong place and wrong time, which is great that it says store cities, Pitom and Ramses. So what do Chazal say? Rav and Shmuel debate. They say actually there's only one city. It was either called Ramses or Pitom. And it could have been called Ramses because it was Pitom is just a nickname because it could have fallen in, or its real name was Pitom. And why was it called Ramses? Because Mitrosses, it collapsed. So Chazal are saying, even though the verse clearly says there were two cities, we think there were only one. We're just not sure what it was named. The archaeologists have found both places, Pi Atum and Pi Ramses. They think they found both. So here's an example where the archaeologists are more fundamentalist about the text than Chazal. That's wild, but that makes you realize that the literary form is nothing to do with historical fact. It's about ways of telling a story.
And I've always said for a very long time that people who are fundamentalists, so to speak, about the text, who demand a literal meaning and understanding of the text, for example, in the first paragraph of Bereishit, they're going against Chazal, because Rashi himself, if you look at him carefully, does not understand it in the classic literal sense that we mean literal.
That's true. And one aspect which directly relates to that, which I'll add on, is I also talk about there's many versions of the Exodus. It's told in other times in Tanakh. There's different amounts of plagues, just like creation chapter one. And we have it in Proverbs 8 and in Tehillim as well. And now you might say, well, yeah, there's the most accurate one. But I follow Chazal. Like I follow Tanakh, I follow Chazal. What do the rabbis do? They take it all as just as important. So they understand that each version has different resonances to it. Because each one, in the context of Psalms, one particular point's being made. In the context of Exodus, another point is being made. So again, that's part of the literary form, even between different books of the Tanakh.
Okay, let's move on to the third, Egyptological resonance. What do you mean by that?
So this began for me when I started going to the British Museum. Actually, I was taken around by Bnei Selavan, a good rabbi friend of mine, a wonderful guide in the Old City, who showed me how many objects in the British Museum have relevance to Tanakh history, literal and indirect as well. And he really excited me about it. And because it's around, not far from me on the train, I've gone literally hundreds of times now, and I've been to exhibitions and seen amazing things that when you know not just the Torah but Chazal really wake you up, like a 2 meter high staff snake, a long metal, and it's actually wavy and it has the feeling of a serpent in itself. And it was an important part of what the Egyptians did. All the pharaohs, when you met them, had these serpents on their foreheads, which clearly relates to the Nachash or the Tanin that Moshe is dealing with. So the overlaps are huge. And when I started investigating it, I realized many archaeologists and rabbis have referred to some of this stuff. And it really helps you understand the imagery of what's going on in the Torah. It's responding to things. I talk about the Yad Hazakah as a response to Pharaoh, but I'll give you another example. There's a verse that says, Lo yechet kelev l'shono, no dog howled. What a wild, weird verse to occur. The only other mention of a dog in the Torah is later on in Mishpatim, where Rashi says that was a reward they get meat because of this one. Why does it mention a dog not howling? What's that got to do with anything? So interestingly, as we know, the god that guided people to the underworld, Osiris is the god of the underworld, but the guide was Anubis, who was a jackal-headed or jackal god, because jackals are nocturnal and scavenge and go near dead bodies. And the howling at night would scare the Egyptians and they'd stay in their beds. So the Israelites wouldn't have left at night because they'd be afraid of the god Anubis. But God, Sa'ar Bahem Shvatim, judged their gods, and the judgment was to silence them. So I noticed that myself as a direct connection, and I spoke to Josh Berman about it, and he said, there's even a Midrash, Rafi, and there's a wonderful Midrash about these, I don't know if you know about it, in Shemot Rabbah, of when Moshe tries to get Joseph's bones to get them, and Joseph was buried in some kind of palace, they say maybe like the Egyptians, and there were these golden dogs surrounding it, Mechashevim, which are magical, and when you went near them, they started barking, and Moshe managed to silence them by saying that Pasuk. And Josh is right. That Midrash is clearly aware of Anubis. So it's not just I'm suggesting there's Egyptological resonance. Chazal themselves, to an extent, were aware of it. They weren't aware of all of the things, but whatever they're aware of, they would notice and they would mention. And so these resonances really help you understand what's going on in the story and make you look at it in a very different kind of way.
Very interesting. And that, of course, helps us understand things that may have been somewhat obscure before. I remember you talk about the word ra. Paro says to Moshe at the beginning of Parsha Bo, he says, Ki ra'a neged pneichem, because ra is coming up against your faces. It sounds like it says evil, but Rashi himself points out that ra is a star. And of course, ra also is an Egyptian god.
Right.
Okay, so now we understand that these ideas can help us understand some ideas that otherwise might have been obscure. How do they answer some of the questions that you raised earlier about the numbers and various other historical questions? It's one thing to say they can give added resonance to certain psukim that were obscure. It's another thing to say they answer the questions that are bothering us because of historical questions.
Yeah, so I ultimately argue that it's not a historical text. It wasn't meant to teach history what happened. It's trying to teach you a lesson of the power of God. And the miracles are the way that we do it, to show the radical change, political change that was made, that in the ancient world, where pharaohs or whoever kings, but obviously Egypt was one of the great empires, you could never escape these things. The power of hierarchy and kings dominated the entire region and the entire world. And the revolution of Torah is that those political structures could be upended and that every human being has a right to be free. And the Torah tells that story through miracles, because I would even argue in that time, miracles were the most compelling thing that would convince people. Even a few hundred years ago, if you saw something miraculously happening, you'll say, I believe it. Today, Scott, some people still go, wow, miracle. Most teenagers, definitely in our community, will look at these things and go, how did they do it? That's the first thing they'll say. So miracles aren't the compelling argument anymore. But to understand that the miracles were to make a political upheaval, that's radical. That's radical. And so the Torah is telling it in that way, in the most dramatic way that it can. So we have to look at the equivalent of miracles today. Look at the irony, right? In Yeshaya, it talks about that in Messianic times, the lion will lie down with the lamb. And that's a metaphor that the nations will get on around us. Woody Allen always said, you know, the lion will lie down with the lamb, but they'll change the lamb every night, right? Otherwise, you know. But the point I'm making is, if I ask a Jew today, what do you think is more likely to happen in the next 100 years? That a lion will lie down with a lamb through some kind of miraculous or, you know, biological thing, or there'll be peace in the Middle East? And they'll say, lion and the lamb, right? It's ironic. Like, what convinces what? What's more convincing? And being convincing or being reasonable, the Torah, just like the Rambam says, is, you know, a Torah Ketuv Kol Shon B'nei Adam, Torah is written in a land which humans could understand. So it doesn't talk about stocks and shares. It talks about cows and oxen goring, because the Israelites at Sinai were 13th century BCE ex-slaves. In a similar way, as well as talking about, as I said, business in that way, it talks about belief in that way. And that's why it uses the language of miracles.
Interesting. Let me ask you about a specific case. Maybe we can look at one or two of them. Paro hardening his heart, or God hardening Paro's heart. It changes from Paro hardening his own heart to God hardening his heart. You mention and describe it in the context of Egyptology, and you use the Book of the Dead. And I found that very fascinating. Could you go through that sugya a bit?
Yes, a few people have done that. By the way, you are right. It does. But when it's always important to notice as well that I think in B'Shalach, when Paro decides to chase after them after all, there's no God there in hardening his heart. He hardens his own heart again.
After they've already left.
Yeah. So there's three words that are used for hardening the Torah. Once it uses the word eksher, which is literally to harden, kasher. And many commentaries have said that's a response to avodah kasher, the difficult work that we had. But then most of the time, it uses two other words, vayechabed lev paro or vechezak, which means to seize or to weigh down. And it's very weird language. It's not used in other places in the Torah. So it seems specific to Egypt. So once you realize that, that's at that point when you look at Egyptological ideas to make sense of that. And so the example I look at, the Book of the Dead were basically scrolls that were buried with middle class or wealthy Egyptians in the New Kingdom. The older kingdom there in pyramids, and the coffins in the Middle Kingdom. But in the New Kingdom, the period where we were there, roughly, 13th, 14th, or 12th century BCE, in that time, middle-class Egyptians and higher would want to survive the underworld, survive and get into the afterlife. And they had to get through many challenges. And they would pay scribes to write all these spells in a scroll that accompany them in the afterlife, so they'd survive and go through. And they're all very different ones. And there was an exhibition in 2010 in the British Museum where they had like 60 of them all unraveled. It was amazing to watch them. And this scene, the weighing of the heart, is in nearly all of them, where the person comes along, and the most famous one, Hunifer's Book of the Dead. And Hunifer was the agriculture minister in Seti I, so Ramses II's father. It's the right place and right time. And it shows him being accompanied by Anubis, and he has to get through the weighing of his heart before he can get through to Osiris, who's the god of the underworld, and then make it to the afterlife. And there's a weighing scale there, and there's two sides. One side is a feather, which is clear from the hieroglyphics, means the god refers to Ma'at, which is the kind of Egyptian view of truth or balance. And the other side is a jar. And in the jar, the hieroglyphics say, is his heart. So even though when he's mummified, four internal organs are taken out into four jars, which, by the way, you know what they're known as? They're called the four sons, pause for effect, of Horus. Right? And in all these pictures, you see Osiris, and in front of him is the four sons of Horus, the four sons everywhere, four, 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 all over the place. I've never found an exact link, but it's fascinating. It's just, I can't prove anything from that, so I didn't put it in the book, but it is fascinating. But anyway, with this bit, Anubis takes them along, and they're weighing his heart. And if his heart is heavy and weighed down, then he doesn't get to meet Osiris, and he is devoured by this horrible monster that's sitting by it called Amit, and he dies a second time, as it were. But if he's not guilty, if he's not immoral, if he's a good person, then his heart is light as a feather. It's balanced. He can go through. So here's an example where the Egyptians believed when they died, you know, the Christians know you go to the pearly gates, right? And the Jews know you might go to Gehinnom and you go to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Egyptians believed that your heart is going to be weighed. And if you're a bad person, it's weighed down. So the Torah uses the language that the Egyptians and the Israelites would have understood. Right? Every Israelite would have known basic Egyptian theology. And so we say God hardens his heart. Pharaoh is not in control. Pharaoh is an immoral person, and God shows that. You think you're a moral person, I'll use your own language against you, as Josh Berman calls it, out-faring the Pharaoh. And I'll weigh down your heart and do that. And so I taught that, and I was privileged to take many people in the British Museum around to see these things. And one of them was Lady Elaine Saxe, who then told her husband, and Rabbi Saxe phoned me about it, and he'd read in other places. And in his last book, I believe, in a footnote, he mentions it, and then in a footnote, he thanks me for that. Now, he heard it from many other places, but I want to teach you about him just for a moment. What he valued young rabbis, and he knew that mentioning them would give them a chizuk and feel good. So he did that in his last book. He mentioned that, you know, he'd learned this from Rabbi Zahn, which was very, very nice of him. So that's an example where the weighing of the heart makes sense. Now, other people have noticed as well. I think Alex Israel and other rabbis have talked about this. I add one more idea on it, which it's in other places, which is this Amit. Because this Amit, by the way, according to hieroglyphics, had the head of a crocodile, the body of a lion, and the tuchus of a hippopotamus, basically, right? And it's a weird kind of, and why? Because those are the three most dangerous animals in ancient Egypt, right? You could die by having your arm bitten off if you're a fisherman by a hippopotamus or a crocodile, and lions attacked as well. And so what interested me is the fourth plague, because the fourth plague is called Arov, which doesn't mean wild animals, and it doesn't mean a swarm. Well, it means a swarm, but it's not gnats necessarily. And all the Haggadahs you look at, they either have another kind of swarm, different to Kinim, some other kind of swarm, or wild animals. Why is it called Arov? Because all the commentaries say it was a mixture. It was a mixture of wild animals. But why is it not called Chayorot then? So I realized, why is it called Arov? Maybe it wasn't a mixture of animals. Maybe it was an animal that was a mixture. It was Amit come to life. Amit would have been the boogeyman of the ancient Egyptians. You know, tell your children at night, if you don't eat your greens, Amit will get you. And so what happened in the fourth plague? They looked out the window and it had come to life. Now, I've been teaching this, Scott, for about 20 years, or in fact, 15 years, this idea. And then I don't know if you watch any of those Marvel TV movies or series. They did one called Moon Knight on Disney last year, which is about a Jewish guy who gets taken over by some kind of Egyptian god and becomes this hero, Moon Knight. And in the first episode, he's in the British Museum. It's not really, because I know the room. And the Amit on the wall comes to life and starts chasing him. And I'm sitting on my sofa watching this going, I said that 10 years ago, like the idea of Amit coming to life. So I actually saw it in front of my eyes. But it could be suggestive, but these plagues are against, and by the way, it says in the Torah over and over again, I'm attacking their gods. So you have to know what their gods were. And the final pasuk that proves this is, it says in chapter 18 of Vayikra, Kamaseret Mitzrayim lo yasu, you mustn't do like the Egyptians. Well, what did the Egyptians do? If I don't know that I can't keep that pasuk. For me, it's almost a mitzvah to visit the British Museum, because now I can understand what the Torah was talking about.
That's a really fascinating example, but let me ask you on that, as long as we're talking about it, I realize it's sort of a side point, but wouldn't that be a reason for the Egyptians to believe that Amit is real? Meaning, if Amit is attacking them, their boogeyman is real, how is that going to be making judgment on Egypt's gods? It's actually bringing them to life.
By the way, it's the same point about Yad Chazakah, right? If God has a mighty hand, whether Pharaoh had a mighty hand, right, or any of these kind of issues, that implies that there's kind of true, or the weighing of the heart, that implies that the afterlife is real and your heart does get weighed. When you fight, you have to understand your enemy. You've got no choice, and you have to follow like they do. We're all so sad about what's going on in Israel at the moment and fighting for our people and the hostages being returned and everything. And the fact that we have to fight our soldiers door to door because the enemy hides themselves. And as a result, there's all these innocents that are being killed that, of course, we're sad about, but we have to fight and bring hostages home. So we have no choice. You have to fight in their way. It doesn't legitimize what they're doing, but you have no choice sometimes. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu gets down into the Egyptian gods and fights them, even though they're not real. Even though they're not real.
It's almost like what you're saying now reminds me of the pasuk in what we call Halal Gadol, Hodu Lashem Kitov, the Perek of Tehillim, Kuf Lamed Vav, 136, where it says, L'makei Mitzrayim Bivchoreihem, to smite Egypt with their firstborn, which, according to the simple understanding, means the firstborn were smitten. But it also is understood by Chazal to mean the firstborn rebelled against Egypt. It's almost the same thing. Their own gods are, so to speak, rebelling against their people who are supposedly supposed to be protecting. It sounds to me it has a resonance to that same idea.
Yes, yes. But the whole idea of recognizing gods seems a bit weird until you realize every time we open the ark, and I tell people this, they always get surprised, we recognize other gods. Ein kamocha ba Elohim, not Elohim, and which means there's no one like you amongst the gods. And no Siddur I've seen, art scroll, Koran, or any other, has had the guts to translate it as there's no one like you amongst the gods. They say no one like you amongst the powers. But that now, Elohim, fair enough, is powers. But Elohim is gods. They translate it everywhere else to mean that. But there's a feeling of the translator, that, oh, I can't say there's no one like amongst the gods. It seems not modern to do that. But the reason I bring that up is to highlight that the Gemara says the gods aren't real, but we call them gods because that's what they call them, and we have to deal in their game. So I really believe that deep down, I'm trying to follow the way Chazal looked at these things, Scott.
Okay, then let me ask one more question about this on the same topic, because I realize we're not going to go through every single question, but because we mentioned it, the sanitation issue and the rabbi who lost his faith because the numbers didn't make sense. Could you just explain quickly why the Torah would use numbers that are simply not accurate? If 600,000 men, meaning 2 or 3 million people, could not be true according to what we know, then why does the Torah use that term?
So there's Kasuto has written about this and others, but there's a wonderful paper about this, which I'll send you if you want. It talks about how many kings in all of English history reigned for 40 years. And the answer is one. Whereas in Tanakh, there's about 15 or 20 of them. Or how many times in the story does it say, and in 3 days later, it was exactly 3 days, the Akedah and so on. You know, when I took kids on Israel tour around Israel, and the kids said, are we nearly there? Are we nearly there yet? And I always said, half an hour. No matter what, I always said half an hour. There's certain numbers and phrases, numbers in the ancient world or the ancient kind of writing, this is again a literary form, aren't literal. As been pointed out by Shamash and others, I think there's no number, in all the numbers in Bamidbar and Pinchas, you know, the census, wrote twice, the number 8 is missing. You ever noticed that?
I have not noticed that.
It's like, why not? Why no 8? What are the chances in 12 numbers times 2 that there wasn't an 8 on the 10s or the 50s or the 100s? So the numbers have meaning, and this is not wild. If you go to Greek thought, the numbers, the magic numbers, all had symbols. We have gematria, for heaven's sakes, even today. So numbers meant something. They never just meant a number. That's the approach of history again, which is not a historical document. We also know from cuneiform texts and hieroglyphic texts that many are writers, not exaggerated, because exaggerate implies it's just bigger, but they chose a number that had significance. And so 600,000 became this general large number. So, for example, the use of the number 400, there are three stories in Bereshit that use the number 400. God tells Avraham that will be enslaved for 400 years. Later, when Avraham buries his wife and he has to bite from Ephron, it's a 400 shekel. And then later on, when Esav comes back to meet Jacob again and he's nervous, he comes with 400 men. Now, it's completely historically possible that each time it really was 400. Just was a coincidence. But really? more likely is 400 means a really big number. And you know, in the Gemara, when Rav Preda is praised for wanting to teach a student over and over again, how many times? 400 times. What are the chances it just happened to be 400? Maybe 400 is the way they would say is the really big number, which is interesting, by the way, because in terms of gematria, tough is 400. It's the big number. It's the one at the end. So in Chazal, maybe, or in the Torah, numbers are always more symbolic, always more symbolic than literal. And then, so when you see a number, don't ask, is that number historically possible? But what does that number imply? And Chazal do this, by the way, a lot of times with numbers. They tell you it was three because of this, it was two because of this. So it's the approach of Chazal. Chazal's approach is normally, what do I learn from this? Not, let me prove that this was the case.
When exactly, Rafi, then, as long as you're mentioning Chazal, when exactly do you feel comfortable saying something which was not mentioned in Chazal? You mentioned earlier Rav Henkin said that it's okay. Do you have any restrictions yourself? Is there any place where you say, well, I can't say that because Chazal go in a very different direction? Is it only in halachic matters that you'll say that I must follow Chazal? In other areas, you're completely free to do so? Or do you have other times that you say, you know, Chazal said this, so therefore I'm going to go with it?
Well, look, you know, we're little people standing on the shoulders of giants. What I learned from Chazal was a derech. It was a derech. It doesn't mean that everything they say is literally true. Their knowledge of science, they admit, was based on what they knew around them, so it could have changed. So their interpretations, when it comes to halacha, are authoritative because we need a community, we need a system in which we live. But on other subjects, did they think, and this is the deeper issue, did they think they were telling us a truth? Or did they think they were teaching us a lesson? And if they thought they were teaching us a lesson, then would they want us to evolve their lesson for now or just quote them? So I think I'm being more faithful to Chazal by taking their project forward than just by reparroting what they said. I could be wrong, but I believe that's a more honest thing to do, to take their derech rather than their literal words. And you can't know that, but you know, if Chazal came back, what would the what would they say? I don't know, but I think they'd want us to be religious and follow these, and I have a deep sense of emunah, but they'd want us to think. I believe I could be wrong. I don't know, but I believe that. So that's the I'm unpacking your question, but I think that's the real truth.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Rafi, let me ask you one question, but it's a big one. My question is about the historicity of Yitzhak Mitzrayim in a general sense, because let me say that I take your question, but go all the way. Let me take it to its extreme. Once we're going to say that the point of the Torah's account is not to teach me history, but to teach me a lesson, in that case, why not just say, I'll go all the way? The Exodus did not happen historically. What the Torah is teaching me is that God frees slaves, that God values, whatever the lessons are, we don't have to unpack that right now. But why do I have to argue that part of it is historical, that it is based on, that it is referring to an historical event, rather than say, it doesn't matter. Why should I care one way or the other whether it's an historical event?
In a sentence, it's a huge question, but in a sentence that I'll expand, it's because God did enter history. And that is the most radical idea that the Torah presents. We believe not just in the God of creation, but the God that interacts personally with history. Exactly what that means and how we understand it is an infinity of complexity to understand. But that's the starting point. And that's why when I begin my response, I immediately, the first thing I do is quote from a secular Jew, Ben Gurion, who said he believed that it was based on a kernel of truth. And then I show that when there was a big conference in San Diego with a whole bunch of Egyptologists, on average, they believe something happened because a moment in history changed the world. And the Torah story is a response to that, of the way we're supposed to understand the significance of that. So it's very important that something happens in history. Why does the Torah tell it like that? So at the end of the chapter, I compare it to cinema. You know, all those movies that say this is based on a true story. Now, if lots of it is made up in that movie, why do they say that? Why does it matter, Scott, to say this is based on a true story? Because then when you're watching, you're thinking, ah, there's a kernel of truth to this that gives more power to the story. It's not just a fictional account. It's based on something that's true. So my answer to you also simply is, it's clearly important because when people, directors bother to put that line at the beginning of movies, and it has a significant meaning to it. And that's why it's done in that way.
Let me ask you a final question with two parts. Part number one is, I'm curious what Rafi Zarim's Seder looks like. How much of this do you bring in to the Seder? How much of this do you leave out? Because do you leave the story as it's presented by the Haggadah and by the Torah itself? Or do you bring in some of these ideas about the various Egyptian gods and the things that we learn out from Egyptology? And along with that, What would you say is the single most important lesson from everything that we learn about Yetziat Mitzrayim? I don't mean historically. I mean from the Torah's presentation of it. What is the number one most important thing that God is trying to teach us through the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim about the Exodus from Egypt that we're supposed to tell our children?
Those are two great questions. So first of all, my Seder is different every year. I'm not a didactic teacher of my Seder. I'm a father. And all these books are around, and some years I have pictures of Egyptian gods, and some years we have place names and hieroglyphics, and sometimes I use this stuff, and other times I don't. It depends. It's different every year, and I'm playful with it, and there's different Haggadahs lying around. And, you know, an idea that I said a few years ago, my children might say, Abba, tell us that idea. We like that, or we don't like that idea. And we engage. It's an ongoing, again, as I say, it's responses. I don't believe we should always have the same answers. That's one thing. In terms of what's the most important message, well, that again, that's personal. People will find different ones that are important. You know, the revolution of the midwives to see these female responses standing up to power is a wonderful lesson that's taught out there. And sometimes I really focus on that. The women of the Exodus is a huge issue, even translated to the halacha of women leaning, right? So the female role in the Exodus is absolutely massive. And it gets translated in the Haggadah with, you know, B'demaya Chayi and the imagery that we have from the Navi. So there's all different messages each time. It's going to have to be the freedom, fundamentally, though, right? That we're not stuck in the ancient world, but the world is changing the whole time. And what you think you're fixed, you're not fixed on. Can I give you one story that happened to me about this? When I was in primary school, they made us write letters to refuseniks, Jews who were behind the Iron Curtain in Russia, who had no chance of escape, and to write to them, to write to Natan Sharansky and others. And a precocious Rafi said, no, what's the point? I'd read about it a little bit. They're stuck behind there. Nothing's going to change. What difference does my stupid letter make? A year later, Natan Sharansky was released. He came to London. He spoke at the Albert Hall. Three schools were chosen, primary schools, elementary schools, children to sing behind in choirs. I was one of them. I stood behind this man less than a year later, and I tried to understand what was going on in my head. Things that I was convinced, Scott, were fixed that could never change. And then Sharansky did the kicker. He said, you know, I didn't arrive today. I arrived yesterday, a day early. And I went to walk around Hyde Park. And I'll tell you why. When I was locked up in prison, they showed me videos. And you probably don't know this, but in London, there was a group called the 35s, these young women who would chain themselves to railing and march around and say, free Soviet Jews, these women. And he said, you know, they showed me videos of these women would walk around Hyde Park and laugh and say, no one cares about you, Sharansky, no leaders. It's just these couple of women that care about it. He goes, you know what? Those women partly kept me going. He tells a story of his siddur of Tehillim, but he said, these women partly kept me going. So when I arrived in London, I didn't come straight here. I went to Hyde Park to walk, to remind myself. And I stood there going, Rafi, you know nothing. Anything you think is fixed can change. The world politically can be turned on its head. And Hashem gave me this message. I feel it was for me to watch this. So that's how I look at what the Torah is doing with this story. Right? If you're from the ancient world and you read this text, you're going, no way. I mean, you have to read all the Mesopotamian texts and the Canaanite texts and ancient. Nothing like this happened. It's totally radical, the idea of the Exodus. That's its message, that the world is not fixed and that people can be free and that there is one God that can make it happen.
Wow. Rafi, I have to tell you, I'm going to say that story, Bli Nedra, at my Seder this year, what you just said. I hope you don't mind, even though it doesn't put you in the best
pleasure.
Light.
I had to learn the lesson. I think growing is the most important thing, Scott.
Well, that's a really meaningful story, and especially given everything that we in Israel are experiencing now, along with all Jews across the world, the thought of how can anything change, even this morning as we're recording, reading about Hamas's intransigence regarding the hostages, and you say, is there any way this could ever end in any positive way? It's a good reminder that Yeshuat Hashem Keheref Ayin, the salvation of God, happens in the blink of an eye. And I really appreciate everything you've taught me today. It's been fantastic. And for those who are interested in the book, Questioning Belief, Torah and Tradition in an Age of Doubt, a link to Amazon and the book will be in the show notes for this podcast. Rabbi Dr. Rafael Zarim, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
Subscribe to The Orthodox Conundrum on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. Please visit jewishcoffeehouse.com for other episodes of The Orthodox Conundrum, as well as many other great podcasts, including Intimate Judaism, The Maimonides Minute, Chochmat Nashim, The Francisca Show, and Let My People Eat. I'd appreciate it if you go to Apple Podcasts and rate and review The Orthodox Conundrum. It takes literally 2 minutes. It's just giving a certain number of stars and writing one or two sentences. please like the Orthodox Conundrum podcast on Facebook and join our growing Facebook group, the Orthodox Conundrum Discussion Group, where you can feel free to discuss issues in Orthodoxy in an honest and friendly environment. I hope you'll become a Jewish Coffeehouse patron on Patreon. Just click on the link in the description of this podcast, and you can get bonus episodes, Jewish Coffeehouse merch, and more. You'll get special episodes on all sorts of topics that are only available to subscribers, and you'll be helping Jewish Coffeehouse spread our message of a welcoming, intellectually engaged, and honest Orthodoxy. Just join Patreon. It's only a couple of dollars a month, and you can stop anytime, so join today. Finally, do you have a message that needs to get out? Do you want to promote your business, your organization, or your cause? The best way is by producing a podcast, and Jewish Coffeehouse can make it happen. I have experience producing hundreds of podcasts, both for myself and for satisfied clients. Whether you want to learn everything you need in one day, or relax and record and let me do the heavy lifting, Jewish Coffeehouse Productions will work with you to make it happen and make it even better than you imagined. Let me help you today. Write to me at scott@jewishcoffeehouse.com or go to jewishcoffeehouse.com, click on Productions, and sign up for a free consultation. Make your voice heard, promote your cause, sell your product, and engage an audience now. I'm Scott Kahn. This has been the Orthodox Conundrum on JewishCoffeehouse.com.